let's have a look at our syllabus here. The course is divided into two parts. The first part will deal with the Dead Sea Scrolls, half the course. Then the second half will deal with New Testament archaeology. Our textbooks will be two books by Vermes here for the first half of the course, Dead Sea Scrolls, Qumran in Perspective, and then English translation of Dead Sea Scrolls. So you'll need those. If you don't have them, get them immediately. And then the second half of the course, John McGray's book, Archaeology and the New Testament. You won't need that for a few more weeks. Then I've listed just some general references there on Dead Sea Scrolls and also on New Testament archaeology. There's just a mountain of material on Dead Sea Scrolls, so I didn't make any kind of an attempt to give you a detailed bibliography. I've just given you some very general references. The most important one, as far as any kind of research is concerned, would be number four, the Fitzmyer book, which is a resource for you if you're doing any kind of further work on Dead Sea Scrolls. That is where you would start, because he gives you all the publications up until 1990 in various areas of Dead Sea Scrolls study. And so that's a very valuable book. I assume it's in the library, although I'm not sure. I haven't checked. The others are just very general, more or less like the Vermes book, except probably Vermes is a little better. But these others are pretty much from a Christian perspective. Number three there deals just with Qumran, basically, the site of Qumran. So Vermes is a pretty good overall introduction to the subject. And then New Testament archaeology, just a few other references for you there. Now, for those taking it for credit, we'll have two exams, one on Dead Sea Scrolls, one on New Testament archaeology. And then, in addition, I would like you to do a term paper. See down at the bottom of the first page the requirements for that, a minimum of 20 pages. And I'd like this when you take the final exam, at least by that time. That would be the latest time you could turn that in. And then if you look on page 2, you'll see our schedule of classes and the reading assignments. The column labeled Qumran is the Qumran in Perspective here, and then the column labeled English is the English translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And for those taking the course for credit, you'll notice that along the way I'd like some input from you on your paper. So in 2 weeks, I'd like you to come up with the subject of your paper. Now, the subject can be anything in this area that we're going to be dealing with, Dead Sea Scrolls or New Testament archaeology. So be thinking about that, and anything, you know, that you would like to do in that area. It could be textual studies or archaeological study, but I'd like to have the subject from you in 2 weeks' time. And then as we go along, if you look at page 3, we'll have an exam on Dead Sea Scrolls on April 6th, and then after that, on April 13th, I'd like to see the outline of your paper. And then May 4th, I'd like to have your bibliography that you've compiled to that point. And then finally, the final product, no later than May 25th. So after, 4 weeks or 4 evenings of lectures, then you'll have your exam on Dead Sea Scrolls, and that'll really end our study on Dead Sea Scrolls, and then we go into New Testament archaeology. Have basically four evening lectures, evenings of lectures on that with a review evening, and then the final exam, which will be strictly on New Testament archaeology. So you don't really have to worry about the last half of the course for the final exam. And of course, for New Testament archaeology, the assignments there are out of McRae's book on archaeology in the New Testament. So that's pretty much what we're going to be doing. Any questions on the course itself?
Yeah,
a
question. Is there a difference between the bishop and the bishop?
Okay. Did that just come out? What's the...
So this is a...
80... Yeah, I think it's been changed. Does anybody have the newer one that should be in the book room? Well, you better check it against the one in the book room. Now, I have the hard copy edition here, which is very expensive, but the last time I checked, the paperback edition was identical. And this is the third edition, 1987. We'll have to double check to make sure the pages are the same, you know. Maybe some of it's the same, but just a little bit of it's different. I have no idea. But I've listed here the particular documents that we'll be dealing with, so at least you can see what it is. And then the pages are different in your book. Maybe you can make adjustments, but you want to make sure that you can read all this material. Any other questions? Yeah.
Those events, is that strictly from your lecture or lecture plus
lecture? Mainly lecture, but there will be some information that's duplicated in the book and in the lecture. Some that's just, I'll give you only in the lecture, that's not in the book. So you need to be here for the lecture. And so it's primarily the lecture. But you should read the book as well, because then you get really more than we can cover in class. Well, tonight we'll just kind of introduce the whole subject of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and beginning next week we'll get into the details of the actual documents. The only way to really understand what's in these documents is to read through them. And so we'll be doing a lot of reading through these documents that were discovered there in the caves near the Dead Sea. It may get a little kind of, it may drag a little at points, but just hang in there, because like I say, you won't get a feel for this material unless you begin to work with it a little bit and read through it and we'll talk about it a little bit in class. So once we get through this kind of introductory material, then we're going to dive right into these documents and kind of plow through them. It may get a little tedious, but I think it's the only way to really become familiar with it. And we'll deal with some of the issues too. Pretty much at the end, in the last class, we'll deal with some of the issues concerning the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay, well, let's get underway then. This sheet will give you a little timeline of some of the key people, rulers, and so on that I'll be talking about. You need to have kind of a little bit of a background of the period to understand what's happening with regard to the history of the people at Qumran. And so that's where we'll begin. And again, this might get a little tedious, but I think it's really necessary to understand the time period that we're dealing with here. The period of the scrolls, or of the community, is basically 150 BC to AD 68. That's when the community existed at Qumran, the community that produced the scrolls. Some of the scrolls are actually older than that, so it's quite clear that the community brought older material with them when they came and settled at Qumran. So really, that's the focus of our attention as far as the historical period is concerned, but we need to back up and start a bit earlier than that to really bring this whole thing into focus. So I'm going to begin with what we call the Hellenistic period. And that's roughly 333 to 142 BC. The ancient Near East was unified by Alexander the Great. And he began this process actually in 334. And then in 333, he conquered the Persians. They were the previous empire and previous rulers of the whole region of the ancient Near East. Alexander, as I'm sure you know, came from northern Greece, an area called Macedonia. And he came out of that area, first of all, conquering the Persians. And then in 332, he conquered Palestine. And so that brought the area of Judea, or Palestine, into the orbit of the Hellenistic Empire. Then Alexander the Great died at only age 33 in 323 BC. He was in Babylon at the time. And his generals, then, of his great army, began to vie for control of various areas and began fighting amongst themselves. And the way it fell out was that a group of people called the Ptolemies took over the rule of Egypt. And I guess that comes from the first general Ptolemy, I'm not quite sure, but they're referred to as the Ptolemies, and they ruled Egypt for many, many years after 323. And then in Syria, the rule was under a group of kings called the Seleucids. So they ruled Syria. And Palestine initially was part of this Ptolemaic Empire. They were ruled initially from Egypt. One of Alexander's policies was that whatever area he conquered, then he introduced the Greek culture to that area. And these generals more or less continued that same policy. They felt that the Greek culture was the only civilized culture, everybody else was uncivilized. And so they worked to introduce Greek culture in all of these conquered territories, including Judea or Palestine. They made a great effort to try to bring the Greek culture to the people, the Jewish people that lived there. And of course, this resulted in some problems because the Jews wanted to maintain their own distinctive culture. The Ptolemies pretty well stayed out of the political affairs of the Jews in Palestine. As long as they would pay their taxes, they didn't really put too heavy of a hand on them. They allowed the high priest to kind of govern the country along with his council. But that changed in 198 B.C. And in that year, Palestine was conquered by the Seleucids, these kings up in Syria to the north. And under their influence, they were much more aggressive in trying to promote Greek culture. A lot of Jews went along with this and gave in to this effort and went along with the new culture and the new ideas and so on. And this resulted in a kind of a polarization. The conservative Jews fought it. Really, religious Jews, Orthodox, conservative Jews fought this new influence. And so you had this polarization of the Jews themselves between those that were kind of going along with the new ideas, the new trends, and those who were resisting these new ideas. In 175 B.C. to 164, there was a ruler of Syria named Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and he's on your chart there. And he began a very aggressive program to Hellenize Judea. In part of that, as part of that process, in 171 B.C., he appointed Menelaus as high priest. Menelaus was not in the line of Zadok. He was not a Zadokite. And so this caused a lot of consternation on the part of the Orthodox conservative Jews, because for the first time they had someone that was a high priest who was not part of the proper genealogical line. So that disturbed people. Then in 167 B.C., Antiochus looted the temple. He set up a sanctuary to Zeus there in the Jerusalem temple, and he went so far as to outlaw Judaism. And this was a fulfillment of Daniel 11, 21-35, where it speaks of the abomination of desolation. And that took place under this ruler, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Well, of course, the conservative Jews would not sit by and allow this to happen. So it resulted in a revolt of the conservative Jews, and this is referred to as the Maccabean Revolt. It's not there on your chart. There was a high priest by the name of Matthias, and he had four sons, Judas, Jonathan, and Simon. The first leader of the revolt was the son Judas, and he was nicknamed Maccabeus. This is spelled different ways. Sometimes there's an A in there, sometimes, usually not, I guess. At any rate, we're not sure where he got this nickname from, but they called him Maccabeus. And then they began to call the other brothers Maccabeus, and pretty soon any warrior or fighter in this revolt was called Maccabeus. And as a result, we refer to this as the Maccabean Revolt. It's not any family name or any particular group. It's kind of this nickname that was applied to these fighters. Eventually, they were able to retake Jerusalem and retake the temple. That took place in 165 B.C. And in fact, that happened on December 25th. 165 BC, the temple was retaken. The Jews cleansed the temple and they reinstituted the daily sacrifice. And as you may know, the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah commemorates this event of the retaking of the temple in 165 BC. Then in 153-152 BC, there was another high priest that was not a Zadokite. Not on the chart there. And this was one of the brothers, Jonathan Maccabeus. He was appointed high priest by the king of Syria, Alexander Balas. He's not on here either. But at any rate, he was a usurper to the throne, and he took over and appointed this Jonathan as the high priest. And as I said, Jonathan was not in the line of Zadok. So they're kind of getting away from traditional practices in this era. Beginning in 142, we have, this is actually called the Hellenistic I period. We get into the Hellenistic II period, it's called. And this goes from 142 to 47 BC. In this period, we have a new dynasty of high priests that were kind of ruling Judea, and these are called the Hasmoneans. And this was a family name. It was the great-grandfather of Matthias, the father of these brothers that led the Maccabean revolt. His name was Hasmon. So that's where the name comes from, but it really refers to these high priests. Starting in 142 or so B.C. And the first of these was, first high priest was Simon. Again, called Maccabees, another of the brothers, Judas, Jonathan, Simon, are all the sons of this Matthias. And so he became the high priest. Beginning with Simon, now this office of high priest took on more than a religious significance. From this point on, the high priest also becomes the ruler, the political ruler of the Jews. So this is kind of a pivotal point of about 143 or so BC. It's a very significant time in the history of Judea for this period. Simon was made high priest in 143, and then in 142, he took complete control of Jerusalem. Prior to this time, the Seleucids still had some amount of control there, even though the Jews were allowed to continue their religious practices politically. The Syrians or the Seleucids were in control, but Simon captured Jerusalem from this political control of the Syrians and made the Jews independent of the Seleucids for the first time. Yeah, 142 is when he retook Jerusalem. He took the political power of Jerusalem away from the Seleucids. Then they began to expand out from there, and they conquered the neighboring territories of Idumea, it was called, down to the south, Samaria up to the north, an area further north called Iturea. But at any rate, they began to expand their area of control until they had quite a large area of Palestine under their rule. Well, this movement was supported by the Sadducees, one of the religious groups of the day, but it was opposed by the Pharisees. So there was this polarization amongst the Jews themselves in that day, kind of along political lines.
This was on the threat of what course would be taken to office?
Yes, the high priest was more or less the king, I guess you'd say. He was the ruler of this area and was the one in charge politically and religiously. A very important figure in this Hasmonean dynasty is a man named John Hyrcanus. Oh yeah, here's John Hyrcanus. Okay, you've got some of these people under Palestinian rulers there on the chart. He was the son of Simon Maccabeus, and under his rule, the Jewish state reached the pinnacle of their power. And from this point on, the political office of high priest dominated over the religious office. The next ruler was Alexander Jannaeus. He's on your chart there, so I don't need to put it on the overhead. He ruled from 103 to 76 BC. He was the son of John Hyrcanus. He was very warlike, and because of his style and his warlike policies, there was a lot of dissatisfaction amongst the Jews, and it resulted in an open rebellion amongst the Jews. And at this time, the conservative Jews, who were called the Hasidim, they organized themselves into the party of the Pharisees. And they openly opposed the rule of the Hasmoneans. Then from 67 to 63 BC, we have Aristobulus II, and he's on the bottom of the chart. He was the son of Alexander Jannaeus. He became the next ruler. And under his rule, there was an open war between Aristobulus and Hyrcanus II. And, he is on the other side of your chart. Both of these were sons of Alexander Jannaeus. Aristobulus was actually the younger son, but for some reason he was able to get the support he needed to take over as the ruler. But then his brother, this Hyrcanus II, gathered support and eventually challenged his brother, and then they had this war. Eventually, Hyrcanus was able to be victorious and take over the rule. He was actually the legitimate heir, and so he established himself as the high priest and the ruler. The next... Yes, Hyrcanus II. Right. That's right. Yeah.
poet that Alexandra, is she a daughter or?
I'd have to look up the family tree. She might have been the wife of Alexander, but I'm not really sure. Well, in 63 BC, the Romans come on the scene. And Roman forces under Pompey intervened in this civil war that was going on between these two brothers. And they captured Jerusalem. There was a bloody siege of Jerusalem, and they captured Jerusalem. They entered the Holy of Holies, but they did not stop the Jews from worshiping there. And it was the Romans then who placed Hyrcanus II on the throne as what is called ethnarch. And they allowed these Hasmoneans to continue the rule of Judea. Then in 48 BC, a man by the name of Antipater comes on the scene. Is he on here? Let's see. He's not showing, I guess. At any rate, he ruled the area of Idumea, south of Judea. And eventually the Romans named him administrator of Judea. Then in 47 BC, Antipater appointed his son Herod as the governor of Galilee. So Herod comes on the scene now. And a few years later, in 43 BC, Herod came into Judea to put down a disturbance there. Of course, the Jews were always having some kind of a disturbance. And he came in with his army and calmed the situation. And so he began then to get involved in the affairs of Judea, the area of Jerusalem. In 42 BC, there was a battle between Herod and Antigonus. Is he on here? Yes, Antigonus is on the chart there. And Herod was able to drive him out, and so Herod established himself as really the dominant leader or ruler in Judea. Then next we come to the, what's called the Roman I period, or the Herodian period. Which went from 47 BC to AD 70. From 37 to 4 BC, Herod ruled the area of what was called Idumea, this area of southern Judea. He was appointed by Rome to be the king of that area. And so he, after being appointed by Rome, captured Jerusalem and established himself as the king or ruler of Judea. And he began a rather cruel rule. He was very cruel to the Jews, and he encouraged the Romanization of the whole area, adopting Roman culture, Roman religion even. Herod himself was half Jewish and half Edomite or something. I think his mother was from Transjordan, I'm not really sure, but he was part Jewish. We have, during this period of 31 BC, an earthquake, a very severe earthquake, that according to Josephus killed between 10,000 and 30,000 people. And when we talk about Qumran, we'll see the effects of that earthquake at Qumran. It did a lot of damage there. In fact, after that earthquake, they abandoned Qumran for several decades. During this time, the Jewish people were very unhappy with Herod, with the Roman rule, and there was more and more discontent. Upon the death of Herod in 4 BC, the territory of Judea was divided among several of his sons. And so the Herodian period continues after the death of Herod because his family, his sons, continued to rule the area, but they kind of divided it up into different parcels. Well, Judea was ruled between 4 BC and AD 6 by Herod Archelaus. Yeah, his on your chart is Archelaus. Eventually, he was deposed by Augustus, the Roman king, because he did such a lousy job of governing the Jews and the Samaritans. There was constant trouble during his reign. So in AD 6, then the Romans began to directly rule Judea. And they established an office of Roman prefect. And so they had their own people ruling the territory. From AD 26 to 36, we had one of these prefixes named Pontius Pilate. Another familiar name between 41 and 44, we had Agrippa I. And he was called king by the Roman ruler Claudius. And after 44 AD, the rulers were called procurators. And these rulers appointed by Rome were very, very corrupt. Their whole reason for accepting the position was to collect taxes, and they had to pay a portion of those taxes to Rome, but most of them went into their own pocket. And so these people were very corrupt and very unfair, and again, this caused a lot of unrest amongst the Jews until in AD 66 to 74 we have the first Jewish revolt. Nero ordered the Jews to offer sacrifices to Rome or to Nero. The Jews refused to do this, plus there were other problems, the taxation, and a lot of problems just build up. Finally, the Jews revolted in AD 66. To put down that revolt, the Roman king sent Titus to the area with the Roman army, and that, of course, resulted in the fall of Jerusalem. 70. The destruction of the temple, and so on. With the destruction of the temple, that led to a decline of the Sadducees, the Jewish sect, the Sadducees, The Essenes were another prominent Jewish sect. We'll talk more about those later on. But they also kind of went into a decline and very soon disappeared. And the only Jewish religious group to survive this calamity of AD 70 was the Pharisees. So they really then carried on Judaism and resulted in the Judaism we know today, which we call Rabbinic Judaism. It was a direct outgrowth of Pharisaism after AD 70. Of course, with the destruction of the temple, the sacrifice could no longer be continued. And we have the beginning of the synagogues at this time, and the Jews worshiping in small groups of their synagogues, and we have the rabbis and so on, and the emphasis on the study of the law. Sort of the last gasp of this process was in AD 74. The Zealots were finally defeated by the Romans at Masada. They held out for several years there on the top of Masada, but eventually the Romans were able to, they built a ramp and the Zealots actually committed suicide, but the Romans did away with that attempt on their part to fight against the Romans. Well, let's talk a little bit about these Jewish sects of the day. Josephus said that there were three major religious groups in his time. He wrote in the first century BC period, or excuse me, first century AD. He said these were the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Now this is probably an oversimplification, because from what we know now from the Qumran materials, it appears that the situation is much more complex than that, with many shades of belief amongst these various groups. It would probably be very much like today if we said, well, today we have Jews and Christians and Muslims. Well, in general, that's true. But in Christianity, my goodness, look at the variety you have. I mean, you have the Catholics, the Eastern Orthodox, and Protestantism, and in Protestantism, you have all of these different groups, churches, and so on. It's very complex. You just can't say that there's Christians, Jews, and Muslims and really understand the religious scene of today. And of course, within Judaism, there's many different shades, and within the Muslim faith, there's many different groups. And it seems that it was the same in these days of the Dead Sea Scrolls. In general, perhaps there were these three Jewish sects, but there was probably many different subgroups under them. And we don't know a lot about these groups. We have very little material surviving to tell us very much about these different sects. We know a little bit, but not an awful lot. As far as the Pharisees are concerned, the name Pharisee seems to come from a Jewish word that means separated. So these were the separated ones. But we don't know what they were separating from. Perhaps the Hellenistic influences, the Roman influences, we don't know. Perhaps from uncleanness, perhaps from liberal Jews, we don't know. But anyway, they considered themselves to be separated from something. They seem to have grown out of these Hasidim, who were earlier very orthodox conservative Jews. The name Hasidim means pious ones, and we even have Jews today that are called the Hasidim, the pious ones, very orthodox Jews. They show up occasionally in some of our records as being involved in politics. For example, they were opposed to the Hasmoneans during that time period. It appears that the Pharisees pretty well controlled the religious life of the day. Josephus says there were 6,000 Pharisees, which is a very small percentage of the population, but they seem to have been very influential as far as religion is concerned. Well, first century AD, during his time. And, well, he's saying in his day there were 6,000 of them.
Yeah.
They were a zealous group. They sought converts. And their main thrust was to uphold the law. Some of the Pharisees were known as the scribes. These were the learned men. And their duty was to safeguard and transmit the scriptures, copy the scriptures, and see that they were properly passed. The next generation. So we have references in the New Testament to these scribes. Jesus talks about the scribes and the Pharisees. Well, the scribes are actually a part of the Pharisees. These were the lawyers or the teachers of the time, and they were very, very influential, and they really replaced the priesthood as far as the ones who were the teachers and the arbitrators and the ones who made the decisions as far as religious matters were concerned. We have some reference to the elders, chief priests. So there were priestly duties, of course, up until the time the temple was destroyed. It seems there were several different groups of Pharisees, but as I said earlier, we really don't know much about the differences between them. According to the New Testament, they believed in the resurrection of the body, they believed in angels, and they believed in additions to the canon, additions to the Old Testament. They believed in the immortality of the soul, they believed in future life. They developed a whole oral tradition, which was an interpretation of the law, and this is what they laid on the people. And this is what Jesus was so adamant against, was this oral interpretation of the law and the expansion of the law and making the people follow all of these rules and regulations that they came up with. Eventually, this was put into writing in the Talmud, and that grows right out of this Pharisaic movement. So in the Talmud we have Jewish civil law and Jewish religious law. Now, the Sadducees, our best source, again, is Josephus. The name means to be just or righteous, and the name Sadducees may mean something like righteous ones. We have references to the sons of Zadok in several documents. Some of the Qumran documents, in fact, speak of the sons of Zadok. And the word Zadokites is very similar linguistically to Sadducees. And so some have suggested that that is where the name Sadducee comes from. That these were the descendants of Zadok, the priestly line. And they were known as Zadokites, and then that kind of got transformed into Sadducees. That's possible, but we're not very certain of that. Of course, the name Zadok means to be righteous, so that meaning would still follow. The Sadducees were aristocratic. The Pharisees were kind of the party of the people, whereas the Sadducees were the party of the wealthy, the influential, the political leaders. The Sadducees were priests, by and large, but there were also some priests that were Pharisees, so not all priests were Sadducees. We're not really sure when the group began. Some say around 143 BC, when the religious power and the political power was brought together. Some think that the Sadducees reacted to that and formed this other group. But again, we're not really sure of that. The Pharisees and Sadducees were hostile to one another. They were always arguing, fighting, and so on, and had totally different viewpoints of things. The Sadducees went along with this Hellenistic culture, the Roman culture, and so on. They went along with the leadership, whereas the Pharisees were more conservative, and they fought against those kinds of things. The Sadducees believed only in the Pentateuch, and they rejected anything that was not written in the Pentateuch. They had no oral tradition. They added nothing to the Pentateuch. They did not believe in an eternal life, resurrection of the body, anything along that line. They did not believe in any kind of an afterlife at all. They didn't believe in angels. They, in their doctrine, stressed the sovereignty of human choice. More or less. The Sadducees were basically humanistic in their outlook on things. From the time of John Hyrcanus the First, 134 to 104 BC, they were very active in the high court and the Senate of Judea. The Jerusalem Sanhedrin, and so they had a lot of political influence as a result of being in the Sanhedrin. Well, let's quickly go over the Essenes, and we'll take a break here. The Essenes, again, they're described primarily by Josephus. We have a couple of other references in Philo, Pliny the Elder, just a very little bit, but mostly from Josephus. They were a breakaway group. Some debate about how they originated. We'll return to this later when we get into the actual Dead Sea Scrolls themselves. But they separated themselves and lived on the fringes of Jewish society. And they were a closed group, and you had to go through a lengthy initiation procedure in order to become a member of the Essenes. They seem to have started around the middle of the second century BC. At least that's when Josephus says they started, at about the same time as the Pharisees and the Sadducees started, in the time of Jonathan Maccabeus, 153-143 BC. And they continued until AD 70 or so. Josephus said there was about 4,000, or more than 4,000, he says, in his day. Pliny says that there was a group living by the Dead Sea, just north of Ein Gedi, and that, of course, is the very area of Qumran in the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were very rigorously organized. Their superiors were elected, and as I mentioned, to get into the organization or the sect, you had to go through a certain process. There was 1 year of probation, and after that 1 year, if you passed the muster, if you lived up to all the requirements, then you were allowed to participate in the ritual bathing. They had daily ritual bathing. The Jews had also ritual bathing during this time period, but these people even carried it to a higher level. I think they bathed twice a day, in the morning before breakfast and then in the evening before their evening meal. After that initial 1 year, then the trainee, or whatever you want to call him, went on for another 2 years of probation, where he was sort of in training. And after the two-year period, if he passed muster again, he took vows as a full member, and now he could eat the common meal with the rest of the members of the sect. A full member swore not to divulge any of the beliefs or any of their doctrines to any outsider. It was a very secret, closed society. Upon attaining full membership, you had to turn over all your earthly goods to the community. And from that point on, your needs were taken care of by the community. If anybody broke one of their rules, he would be punished, and they had various punishments depending upon the offense. They had a tribunal of 100 judges that would review cases and decide penalties and so on. The ancient sources say that the Essenes were celibate, but Josephus says that there was one branch that did permit marriage. So it seems even within the Essenes there were various beliefs and practices. These people were very critical toward the temple. They felt that the worship there in Jerusalem had been corrupted, and that seems to be the reason they broke away, was to reestablish the pure Jewish religion in accordance with the Old Testament. They didn't offer sacrifice. They had to sort of develop their own theology because of the fact they did not worship at the temple. And we'll get into this more when we get into the scrolls themselves, because it appears that the people at Qumran were Essenes. Some that would take issue with that, but I think most scholars believe that the scrolls were written by members of the Essene sect. Their meals were very solemn and eaten together in a communal hall. It was only open to members. It was much like a Passover meal or a communion meal, something like that, but it was practiced every day. Their schedule, so to speak, was to get up in the morning, go through this ritual immersion, this ritual bath. They would put on white robes, go in for the morning meal, eat together. Then they would change into their work clothes. They'd work all day long at various tasks. And then in the evening, come back, again have the ritual immersion, cleansing, put on the white robes, and then go in for the evening communal meal.
Means they took like the 72 meals.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They had priests, and these priests prepared the food for them, and they had grace before the meal and after the meal. According to Josephus, the Essenes believed in life after death. They believed that the righteous would be vindicated and live forever in God's presence. Okay, well, I think that's...
Scroll discoveries. The first finds were made accidentally, as you probably know, in the spring of 1947, when some Bedouin shepherds found some scrolls in a jar in what we now call Cave 1. Here's Cave 1. It's a couple of kilometers north of the site of Qumran, where the ruins are of the community that produced the scrolls. It's along a line of cliffs here. As you can see, the Dead Sea is over here to the east. And running north and south, we have this line of cliffs. And there are many, many caves here in those cliffs. And the people at Qumran here hid their scrolls in a number of those caves. So the very first discovery was made in that cave one just north of Qumran. The documents were sold to an antiquities dealer in Bethlehem, and he in turn sold them to, he divided them into two groups, really. One group went to the head of the Syrian Orthodox Monastery of St. Mark in Jerusalem, a man named Archbishop Samuel. And then another group was sold to Eliezer Shekinik, professor of archaeology at Hebrew University. These Cave 1 scrolls are very important. This cleric, Samuel, he paid $100 for the Manual of Discipline, Commentary on Habakkuk, and it's called the Genesis Apocrypha. These eventually were purchased by Yigal Yadin, son of Shekinik. Quite a story behind that. We'll hear more about this, the details of this in the next class. I'll be showing a video next week that will kind of review some of this, so I won't go into a lot of detail at this point. Eventually, he wanted $1 million for these documents. He came to the U.S. and was trying to sell them here. Nobody would pay that much, but ultimately, Yigal Yadin purchased them for $250,000. So he made a tidy profit, purchased them for $100, sold them for $250,000. And so they were taken back to Israel. Then the other group was sold to Shekinik. In 1947. Then these went to Yadin in 1955. Shekinik purchased a complete scroll of Isaiah, he produced a group of hymns, very much like the biblical Psalms, although they weren't the Psalms, but very similar. And then a document called the War Between the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness. So that was the material from Cave 1 that is now all in the possession of Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and much of it is on display in the Shrine of the Book, which is adjacent to the Israel National Museum in Jerusalem. Well, for a number of years, the exact location where this material came from was not known. But in 1949, this area of Qumran was under the control of Jordan at that time. And in 1949, they sent the Arab Legion into this area, and they began searching all over the place. And they eventually located the site in late January 1949. And so shortly thereafter, some archaeologists went to the site, G. Mr. Harding and William Crowe, and they explored the cave, and they found hundreds of manuscript fragments. The Bedouin, of course, only took the what looked like complete scrolls. They were originally in a jar. The jar had been broken. They took these scrolls out. But on the floor of this cave, there were a lot of smaller fragments. And these fragments represented 72 different manuscripts that had originally been stored in the cave, but now they're largely gone for various reasons, and all were left with fragments. They also found some artifacts in the cave, suggesting that the documents were ancient. Of course, that was the first question: how old are these manuscripts? At first, people thought, well, they're frauds, either something very old. Nobody would accept that they were ancient, but this archaeological material, pottery, coins, and so on, suggested that these documents were very, very ancient. At the same time, these archaeologists went to the ruins of Qumran, just a couple of kilometers to the south of Cave 1. Looked around, and they concluded that it was nothing more than a Roman fortress dating to the 3rd or 4th century AD. So they didn't pay too much attention to Qumran at that time. Then in 1951, they began excavating in Qumran 2 years later, and very quickly they realized that there was a connection between this site and the scrolls, because they found pottery at the site is identical to the pottery they found in Cave 1. So that then brought the importance of this site to their attention, and they sort of excavated for quite a number of years following 1951. While the Bedouin continued to search the area for more scrolls, because now they realized how valuable they were. In February 1952, they found Cave 2, very close to Cave 1. And here they found some fragments, and these fragments were sold to the authorities. They represented 33 different manuscripts. The antiquities people established a set rate to pay for these fragments, so much a square centimeter, so that it was a very, very good way to earn extra money for these Bedouin looking for fragments of manuscripts. Then the archaeologist, after this, thought that they had better start looking around the area, so Roland DeVoe followed up, and he began to search the area, and he discovered Cave 3 up to the north here, where there were fragments of 15 manuscripts, and also he discovered Cave 5 right next to the ruins of what we call Kerbet Qumran, and here he found fragments of 25 manuscripts. In that same year, 1952, The Bedouin discovered Cave 4 here, which is right across the wadi from the ruins of Qumran, and this proved to be the richest deposit of all. In this one cave, there were remnants of some 574 manuscripts. Unfortunately, they were in very fragmentary condition and they were all jumbled up. It's been estimated that there were some 15,000 fragments there in Cave 4. There were holes in the wall of this cave. It was a man-made cave. And the holes suggest that there was shelving in there, and probably it was sort of a library and repository for the community, which was just across the wadi from this cave. The other thing about the cave was that it was basically inaccessible. You had to come down from the plateau above on a rope to get into the cave. And that's how the first got into it, how the Bedouin got into it, but they very quickly dug a hole through the ceiling so that you could get into the cave from the area above without being on a rope. Then also in 1952, Cave 6 was found, and it had some 31 manuscripts represented. In 1955, DeVoe found caves 7, 8, and 9 right in the same area. 19 manuscripts, 8, 5 manuscripts, 8, 9, just one manuscript. And also he found cave 10 in the same area with one manuscript. When I say manuscript, I mean one manuscript represented could only be just a fragment. In 1956, then, the last of the caves was discovered by the Bedouin here, number 11, to the north. And this contained several large documents. It included the Psalms scroll, an Aramaic paraphrase of Job, with about 25 copies represented in the cave. And then the largest of all of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Temple Scroll, was found here in 1956 by the Bedouin, but they held on to this one. They didn't sell that right away. The other scrolls they sold to the authorities. But this Temple Scroll was kept while they gave it over to a antiquities dealer in Bethlehem. Actually, he kept it. I'm not sure if he paid the Bedouin or just what, but at any rate, this antiquities dealer was trying to sell it and get a large price for it, since it was a very well-preserved scroll, and it was the largest, the longest of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so negotiations went on for years, and Miguel Yadin was the one involved in the negotiations through an intermediary. Yigal Yadin did not know who had the scroll and who he was dealing with, and it turns out it was a Baptist minister that was the intermediary between Yigal Yadin and this antiquities dealer in Bethlehem. And the poor Baptist pastor thought he could really work out a deal between the parties, but it turned out the Bedouin or the antiquities dealer just were very unreasonable, kept changing their price, and it dragged on for years. Finally, Yadin gave up on it, but over the course of these years, Yadin got enough information that he knew where it was held, who had it. So in 1967, the Six-Day War broke out, and the Israelis took the area of Bethlehem as part of this West Bank area. So, like the same day, Yadin sent an army officer down there. I think the guy volunteered, actually. I think Yadin said something about I'd really like to go down to Bethlehem because I know there's another scroll down there. And I think this officer volunteered. Yeah, Dean has a book about the Dead Sea Scrolls. He tells all about it. It's quite an exciting story. At any rate, an army officer went to Bethlehem and acquired the scroll. They ended up just taking it. I think they tried to reason with the guy, pay him some money, and he wanted $1 million or something. They ended up just taking it from him, but they eventually did pay him. They paid him a pretty good price, several hundred thousand dollars, I think. I can't quite remember it. You can read all about it in Nadine's book. So that was then the last of the Dead Sea Scrolls to be acquired. This was in 1967. Unfortunately, this dealer hid the scroll under the floor of his house. It was very damp there, and it suffered quite a bit of deterioration between the time it was discovered in 1956 and the time Yadin got a hold of it in 1967. That's unfortunate, but it was, but at least we did finally get it. It's in fairly decent shape.
How much of the scroll is it? I mean, what's
it's
the books are.
It's deals with the temple. It's called the Temple Scroll. It's 28 feet long. I think some of the beginning sheets are missing. It's written on leather. I think there might be a couple of the panels at the beginning that are missing, but it's pretty well intact. And it has to do with the building of the temple. These people at Qumran believed that they would be involved in a great battle, which is described in this war between the sons of light and sons of darkness. In the end time, they believed that they would be victorious. Of course, the Messiah would be leading them in this great battle. And after the battle, and after their victory, then they would rebuild the temple. And this scroll gives all the instructions for rebuilding the temple. We'll talk more about the temple scroll in another class. Now, these are the generally what are called the Dead Sea Scrolls, but there were other manuscript discoveries made in the area. In the area of Wadi Murabat here, there's a number of caves, which are referred to as the Bar Kokhba caves. These were discovered by the Bedouin, and Roland DeVoe and Harding went down there in 1952. And they found four different caves. And these caves were occupied by the Jews at the time of the rebellion in the 2nd century AD, in the time of Hadrian, called the Second Revolt, or the Bar Kokhba Revolt. Revolt was led by this Bar Kokhba. And anyway, some of those people hid in these caves, and they had certain documents, letters, and so on. They're in the caves, and they were left behind, and they discovered in 1952. We don't need to go into a lot of detail about them, but they come mainly from the 2nd century, and there's a couple of documents from later, 8th or 7th century B.C., some document, not biblical, but some other document from 8th or 7th century. They found there in 1955 a scroll of the Minor Prophets. Altogether, about 173 manuscripts were found in these Wadi Murabat caves. And then up here in a place called El Mir, here, halfway between Jerusalem and the Dead Sea, they found a monastery in the desert there, and the Bedouin found some manuscripts there. Greek New Testament, Aramaic Old Testament fragments from between the 5th and 8th centuries. And this site has since been excavated with additional manuscripts found. About altogether 100 manuscripts were found from the community. And then in the 1960s, they investigated some caves south of Ein Gedi off our map, called the Nahal Hever Caves, or the Cave of Letters. The Israelis under Yigal Yadin searched this area between 1960-1961, and they found a number of caves in this Nahal Hever, that the Nahal means a riverbed. They found, again, documents from the Bar Kokhba period, the 2nd century AD, some biblical fragments, and quite a large private archive of Aramaic and Greek and Nabataean deeds dating between AD 93 and AD 32. This is from a lady, Jewish lady named Babata. She was the daughter of Simeon, and it has to do with her property and so on. Then there were some parchment fragments belonging to the Greek minor prophets. So it was a fairly important supply. And then Masada, further south, along the Dead Sea, was excavated by Yadin in 1963 to 1965. And there he found a few more fragments of manuscripts. He found some biblical fragments from Genesis and the Psalms. 26 large fragments of Ecclesiasticus from the Apocrypha. And a small scrap from a sectarian angelic liturgy. And this is important because the same document was also found at Qumran, so that provides a link between Masada and Qumran. There were some Hebrew and Greek papyri, and a lot of ostrich, broken pieces of pottery and writing on. So these manuscripts then are in addition to what we call the Dead Sea Scrolls. Altogether, about 1,300 manuscripts are represented in all of the finds from the Dead Sea area. Now, as far as Qumran is concerned, we have 574 different manuscripts from Cave 4. We have 227 from all other caves. That gives us a total of 801 total different manuscripts represented. In some cases, it's only a few fragments, in some cases, more, and in a few cases, we have complete documents. Now, out of that 801, we have 221 which are biblical. These counts vary depending on the source. So don't think this is the last word. You may read something different from another book. And this handout is kind of a rundown of the various texts, biblical texts, that have been found. So then that leaves, of the 801, 580 which are non-biblical. When I say biblical, I mean according to our canon of the Protestant Old Testament. There's a lot of apocryphal material. The Catholics would say, of course, that that's biblical, but I have thrown that over into the non-biblical category. And we'll be dealing primarily with this non-biblical material, although I'll say something about the impact of the biblical text, what we have learned from them, the significance of them. Now, there's been a lot of publicity in recent years about the unpublished material from Qumran. A lot of it has been published, but yet there's a large body of material that has not been published. And you probably read something about this in the media. And in the video next week, we'll get a very good review of that whole situation. But as a result of the pressure put on the people working on the material, they have now released this to the public domain, and anybody can have access to it. Before, in recent years, the access was limited to just people assigned the publication rights to the various scrolls. So now it's much different, it's wide open. But at any rate, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about as far as this unpublished material is concerned, from caves 1, 2, 3, 5 to 10, that's all been published. From cave 11, nearly all published. A little bit left yet there. I think most of it is completed. The work is completed, and I think it's in the process of being published. The unpublished material basically comes from cave 4. And here we have 100 manuscripts published. And 474 unpublished. So this is what all the fuss is about right here. The cave 4. 474 unpublished manuscripts. And there's a very good reason why it hasn't been published, because this is the very fragmentary material, about 15,000 fragments that I mentioned earlier. That's all jumbled up. And so they have had to match up these fragments. And it has taken a long period of time to do it. That work has been completed. They have matched up as best they can all these bits and pieces, and in fact they have been working on publishing the material, but it's just taken a very long time. And there's been a lot of problems with regard to the people working on the material. They do not receive funding, and weren't able to spend much time, and so on and so on. Anyway, the whole thing has kind of changed now, and it's a real effort to get all of this material published over the next 10 years or so. I think they're saying by 1995 they'll have everything pretty well completed. So, I've mentioned the fact that most of the material is fragmentary, but we do have a few complete documents. In Isaiah, we have two copies from Cave 1. One is totally complete, the other is almost complete. Then, from the book of Job, we have an Aramaic copy. Cave 11. And then Psalms, we have a complete copy from also from Cave 11. So that represents the complete books that we have, complete manuscripts that we have as far as biblical material is concerned. Beyond that, we have every book of the Old Testament represented amongst the fragments, with the exception of Esther. Esther is the only book of the Old Testament not represented in the Dead Sea Scroll material. But that appears to be simply an accident of preservation, because the Qumran people did have copies of the Book of Esther there, because they refer to it in their other writings. The Damascus document, for example, refers to Esther. So it's just the fact that
It was not preserved. Did not survive the centuries since the scrolls were hidden. All of the material was, as far as we know, was placed in the caves by the people at Qumran. And probably this was done when the Romans came through that area. The Romans were going down to Masada to fight the Zealots that were there on top of Masada. And so they captured Qumran on their way to Masada. It appears that the people living there, the Essenes, hid their scrolls in the caves and then fled as the Romans were approaching. And it appears that they had the intent to return once things became safe again. We have the idea that they would return and take up their life there out in the desert. And of course, that never happened, and the scrolls remained there until 1947. When they were discovered by these Bedouin shepherds. Now, because it is so dry there in the area of the Dead Sea, the scrolls were preserved. If it wasn't for the climate, they would not have survived. So, we can be thankful that these folks chose to live in the desert and that they hid their scrolls in those caves. Scrolls up in the area of Jerusalem would never survive because it's simply too damp. Rain. But in the area around the Dead Sea, it's very dry, so the scrolls, which were written largely on skins, on parchment, survived. There were also a few documents written on papyrus, basically paper. They survived as well. So all of that
survived. When you pass it up some terms here that you will run across in the reading.
Such things as parchment and papyrus and scroll and codex and all these terms that biblical scholars throw around.
Particularly when you begin to read about the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're throwing these terms around left and right, and then they no longer find what they're talking about. So hopefully this will guide will help you in your reading. Okay, I think that's enough on the manuscripts themselves. What I want to do for the rest of our time is to talk about the site of Qumran, the ruins there.